Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Komen, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire.
Yes.
With my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man. What is going on with you?
Oh, not too much. As I say, future mayor, it makes me think about our current mayor.
Yeah, she's crazy going nuts lately, isn't she?
It's heating up down there, man.
I haven't been able to watch much news lately, but I heard something. She was at the city council.
Let me bring you up to date. Let's get a little background information before we get to the news of today.
Good.
So you are, of course, familiar with the Officer Vappy story.
Yeah, and he's
under indictment.
Yeah.
I don't know, 9 counts or something, maybe more than that, of fraud. And she is named as city official number 1 in the indictment.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's better than being number 2.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think
in this case it's actually worse.
Yeah.
But that was a month or so ago. And then a new set of indictments came down recently.
Right. Go ahead.
This guy, Randy Farrell. And he was a city contractor who was bribing the people in some shenanigans in the city's permit department.
Right.
And turns out, now there's this guy, Fuad Zeitan, Fred the Painter, also known as. And he's a criminal.
I hear he paints fences.
Business.
Is that it?
Man, well, Fred the Painter painted my house.
Oh, really?
Actually, going back years. And he was a guy, he's out of the painting business now, but at one time he would go around and I guess he would paint houses for free for politicians, and he'd get them to write a nice letter to him. He'd take pictures of the house and he'd go around and sell people on the painting, on the job. And then,
did you like the job he did on your house?
I did not, because he tried to do to me what he did to a lot of people, which is he gets a signed contract, you know, which looks all good on paper and the schedule of how you're going to pay the deposits and all. And then as soon as the job starts, he starts leaning on you to try to get ahead in the deposits.
Oh.
And then once he gets ahead enough,
he leaves.
He walks away from the job.
Right.
Now, I wouldn't let him do that. And he's a former boxer. So he's like big, you know, kind of intimidating guy. Not a tall guy, but a broad guy, you know, a strong guy. And he would, like, get you in a kind of a you know, like real, almost a headlock, kind of like, hey, buddy, here, walk with me. Well, let's talk, you know, I need you to help me out here. And I wouldn't do it anyway. I knew he was a criminal and he actually has gone to jail before. But he's out and he's a close associate of Mayor Cantrell's. And I know this because at her first inauguration he's there at all the functions.
Yeah.
He's there putting his heavyweight or his middleweight belt around
him. Now, do you think he eats a lot of paint chips?
Well,
could that be his problem as a kid, maybe?
I think he had problems before. I don't know about his childhood.
But go ahead,
But anyway, so he's involved in this foolishness. Now, he went down for art fraud and insurance. It's actually insurance fraud. He's trying to make a claim on some paintings that were actually not stolen. Now, the FBI seized his cell phone. As they start going through his cell phone about his case, they find all these text messages between him and this guy Randy Farrell concerning gifts that they're giving to the mayor in exchange for her firing this person off of the city permits department who was scrutinizing their shenanigans.
Right.
Anyway, this is all alleged in the indictment, and a second indictment here. She's also named as city official number 1.
Ah.
And now they had a former U.S. attorney or assistant U.S. attorney in the newspaper today talking about how it's very rare for the government to name someone gratuitously in an indictment. You know, the fact that they name city official number 1, it's not a good sign for her. So she hasn't said anything about this and clammed up, you know, and then now she finally showed up at the city council meeting today. And made a big show, a big blustery show, and said, well, I guess the end of my administration is going to be like the beginning of it. Accusations.
And she said something like, I came in fighting, I'm going to go out fighting.
Right. Well, she may go out in handcuffs, perhaps.
Well, so, you know, she's got, you know, know, she's got like at least another year in office, doesn't she? Yeah.
Well, look, you know, it she can finish out her term and still go to jail.
We'll see.
You know,
but
man, oh man, it's.
Now, this guy, didn't he have something to do with the Hard Rock collapse?
Well, I don't know about that, but certainly the permits department under her watch was the people that didn't go and inspect the Hard Rock, which resulted in its collapse. I mean, that's amazing that there hasn't been more criminality traced back to her. But who knows? When you start pulling on the thread of the sweater, who knows how far it unravels, you know?
Well, yeah. She's crazy, man.
So anyway, that's a lot of excitement there.
Yeah. We'll see what the next few months brings as far as our Mayor LaToya. And, but anyway, yeah, so that's crazy. A lot of stuff going on.
A lot. Yeah, you have something there?
Yeah. This is something that happened. You were out of town, and I saw this story. This, you know, you're always hearing stories about people on planes now. There's always a fracas on a plane. People
right.
Fighting, people like, you know, arguing, and the stewardess getting involved, or the punch getting punched or whatever.
Right.
The pilots have to come out. They have to delay the flight. Now, all this stuff happens on planes now.
It didn't used to happen.
Yeah, it didn't. When I flew, it was like you get in your seat, you stay calm, you read a magazine. You
right.
Go. But now all this stuff's happening on planes. But now, apparently, there was a man, I think it was on some foreign airline, like New Zealand airline or Aer Lingus.
Okay.
It's one of those airlines. But he was kicked off the plane because he was bleeding too much. Apparently he had a wound to his head or something, or his neck, and it had a bandage, but it just kept bleeding.
It's a biohazard.
Yeah, so they asked him to leave.
Sure,
and
I think
he was too weak to argue because he was bleeding so much. You know, but it's crazy going nuts what's going on planes, you know? It just seems like there's always a story. Every day I see a story, you know, Karen kicked off plane for, you know, not wanting to let anyone use the bathroom or something,
right.
You know, things like that. But this guy, and I saw a little bit of the footage of it, you know, they said, and it apparently, because I guess the flight was going to be like a five-hour flight or something.
Uh-huh.
And I guess, you know,
they didn't want him to bleed out on the flight.
Well,
right?
Yeah, you know.
I understand.
So, yeah, he was kicked off the plane. Because that's, you know, the headlines are always a thing that grab me. You know, it's like, man kicked off plane for bleeding too much.
Right.
You know? Then you read, sometimes you read the story and it's bullshit. It's like
clickbait, call that.
Yeah. But this was actually a true story because they had some photos. And he was like a guy a little younger than us, you know, and he was flying alone.
Was there like blood all down his shoulder?
Well, it was kind of like, you know how Trump had that thing on his ear?
Uh-huh.
It was like a bigger one on his like neck, shoulder area.
Uh-huh.
And it just, you could see it like it was seeping through, you know. It was just like, whoever did the suture, you know, didn't do it too well.
Kind of a rush job.
Yeah, you know, because he had to catch a flight.
Right, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So,
somewhere to be.
You know, So he was kicked off for bleeding, and I hope he's okay.
Yeah. I hope he. Well, you know, they always say those head wounds. You know, like if you cut yourself shaving,
right.
It's hard to stop it, you know.
Well, hey, you know, I had years ago, there was a student worker. It was a great kid from Michigan, bright kid. He would work for me. And he cut himself shaving, and he came to work, and he had a little tissue on his thing, and it just kept bleeding. And bleeding and bleeding like on his chin. So I said, you got to go.
You sent him home.
Go home, you know. And he ended up having some like weird cancer.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And
you might have saved his life.
Yeah.
Then.
Well, okay. I said, go to the campus nurse or doctor or whatever.
Okay.
Next day I saw him a week later in the hospital.
Mm.
I went to visit him.
Oh.
And apparently the doctor prescribed a lot of Mountain Dew. For him. I don't know why.
Surprising.
Yeah. He was fine. He recovered and all that. But I went to his hospital room and there was just liters of Mountain Dew everywhere from all his like dorm mates or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know what that had to do with
it. It has a lot of caffeine. I could see it blow, sending your blood pressure through the roof that makes the heart pump faster.
I
you know,
guess.
You're going to lose more blood.
He's a good kid. He's one of those kids. He was like shorter than me, but he had like the biggest feet ever. I could not believe the size of his feet.
Okay, it's got a good foundation.
Yeah. Anyway, I think he's living in some ranch or barn in Michigan now. I have no idea.
All right.
But anyway, yeah, so, you know, things happen like that.
Well,
people bleed.
Sure, yeah. They say only women bleed, but that's
right.
Not true.
That's not true.
Now, you know, you're talking about the flights. I would... I would say, you know, when people dressed up in coats and ties on the airplane, there wasn't all these fights. And now people go on in flip-flops.
Yeah.
And I think there's a connection there.
Well, yeah.
People have no class. That's what I'm saying.
No, they're not in first class, for sure.
No, well, even the people in first class don't have any class.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, back in Los Angeles where I grew up, I remember my parents, you know, like every 3 months, they'd say, "We're going to Vegas for the weekend, kids. You're on your own," mm-hmm. you know? And they would be dressed to the nines,
right.
man, you know? So when I started going to Vegas, I would dress like my dad, uh-huh. you know? Nice, you know, sharkskin suits and all that kind of stuff. Right. And then if you back get into the late 80s or something, it's just like people in shorts.
Bermuda shorts.
Yeah, you know, smiley face shirts and stuff like that.
Right. I'm with stupid.
Yeah, at the high rollers table. It's, you know, it's just like, they'll take anyone's money, of
course. Takes all the fun out of it.
Takes the class out. The class. The class, again, you know. But, so that's going on. And also while you were gone, there was a story, I think it was somewhere in Slidell, where a man who has this coffee shop, I think it was a Starbucks or maybe not, but I guess business was so bad that he locked all his customers in the store.
Wow.
He wouldn't let them leave.
That's a crime.
Yeah, well, it was a crime. You know, it's called
kidnapping.
Yeah, it's a federal crime. Yeah, but business was so bad that he didn't want them to leave.
Huh.
You know, so crazy stuff like that goes on.
Who knows? People have bad judgment.
Yeah.
Well, something else that happened while I was gone. This is kind of old news, but I know you might have some insight here. So, you know, Jane's Addiction was on
I've
tour.
Been following that, yeah.
Right? And they'd gotten through maybe, I don't know, 5-6 dates, maybe a week of dates or something.
Yeah.
And then they were playing that one gig.
In Boston.
In Boston, and
Perry, you know, punched in.
Perry is screaming, trying to scream over the loud guitars, and he goes over and he kind of pushes Dave, and Dave's like, "What the fuck, man?" Puts his arm up, and then Perry tries to throw a punch, doesn't really land, but everybody jumps on the sound crew, the drummer. I think the drummer punches Perry in the stomach about three times.
Something like that. No, I think that was the bass player.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because Steve Perkins, the drummer, he's too mellow of a guy to do that.
Okay,
it was the bass player because he's got some history with Perry. I forget his name, though.
So you know all those guys, right?
Well, I've met them, you know, through, you know, in passing.
Okay.
I met them. Okay. I remember.
I think it's Eric Avery.
Eric, that's it, yeah. And, you know, I always thought Perry was a little insane. You know,
a little nuts. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it comes
at
off
times
like
that I've, you know, I, well, you know, we did things together.
Sure.
did illegal things together, Perry and I.
Right.
He had a house though near Venice, where he had this pool, and it had this. He had a wave maker in his pool.
Mm.
This wave maker, mm-hmm. very cool. And he used to love swimming against the waves. That's how he kept in shape and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, his Dave's guitar tech, I forget his name. I think his name was Lowry or Sydney or something like that. He's got a podcast.
Oh, okay.
And his last episode talked about the whole tour.
Oh, all right.
What led up to
interesting.
That.
Okay.
You can find it on YouTube, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, okay.
But he said that, you know, they finally got the band together back, you know, because they've always been fighting. They're a band that fights.
Right.
You know, they've broken up, they've gotten together, they've broken up. But this tour started, the first show was in Vegas, and they as a group decided, you know, because Perry used to like to have his wife and a bunch of other girls dance in the back, you know, in the background. They always had dancers and stuff like that. And the group said, let's just be a band and play music.
Uh-huh.
Forget all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know? But Perry's a showman, you know. So what he did was, apparently, and this started the first show in Vegas, Perry's nowhere to be found. It's like 5-6 hours before their gig in Vegas. He finally shows up, and he went out to the desert with a camera crew and filmed his wife and all their dancers in the desert dancing. And he was going to project that in the back of the band. And the band's like, nah, it's 3-1, Perry, you're outvoted. And then he said, well, I'm done. I quit. Something like that. And he left. And they're like, well, it's the first show of our reunion tour. And we don't have our lead singer. What do we do? And then click, click, tick, 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 tick. He shows up about a half hour before they go on. And they had a great show.
Uh-huh.
And then they had about a series of very good shows. And then they got to Tampa. and they had a Perry had a meltdown. Mm. And then they, the second show in New York, he had a meltdown. And then Boston was the biggest one.
Oh, okay. So it was building there.
It was
the end.
Building. Apparently, you know, you heard Perry's wife announce that the band was too loud for him and all that
right.
kind of stuff.
That wasn't true.
But apparently, this guitar tech who has got this podcast said that all the shows were great. The shows that weren't great were the shows that where he was partying, where he was taking doing something,
okay.
drinking, or who
right,
knows what
right,
he was taking.
Right.
So yeah, I they're over.
Well, so then they canceled the rest of the tour. Mm-hmm. Now that's the shocking part to me. That's the part where I went, oh wait a second, are you not familiar with the foundational axiom of show business, that the show must go on? And because look, man, you were in a band. I'm sure you were in a band that had some volatile personalities during a volatile time in all of our lives. And myself, you know, I've been in many bands. I can't count the number of times I wanted to punch somebody on the bandstand. And it never broke up the band. It didn't make me quit the band, you know?
Well, no, I you know, they're different though, because they've always been, you know, as long as I've, you know, been.
Well, should be used
them,
to it, man.
Yeah, you know, they've always been kind of just, you know, I remember there's that documentary that came out in the early 90s where there's footage of Avery and Farrell sound checking, and Avery just puts his bass down and just goes over to Perry, and they just start slugging it out. You know, I forget the name of that doc, but it's about Jane's Addiction. I'm sure you can find it.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I was very curious when I woke up that one morning after the Boston show and I read it on my phone. I was like, whoa, it doesn't surprise me.
Right.
You know, it doesn't surprise me.
Well,
but also, Perry, he looks like he's into plastic surgery.
I saw that, man. It looks weird. Yeah, he looks like a wax figure or something.
It's not good. What's going on with this guy?
Men, don't get plastic surgery. Ladies, don't get plastic surgery. Okay, it's not going to end well.
Well, get it in certain places.
Well, okay.
It's okay with me.
But, well, you know, we have a couple of corrections from last week I want to address. You know, you see in the newspaper, they have the little corrections right on the second page, right down at the lower left-hand corner.
So what did you say?
So this is one where we were talking about Joey Buttafuoco, you having brunch with Joey Buttafuoco.
Well, yeah, we were at the same brunch, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I wasn't having brunch with
him. Well, I mean, you were hanging out with him during brunch.
A little bit.
But we couldn't come up with the name of the girl who shot him.
Oh, right.
It was Amy Fisher.
That's it.
Amy Fisher.
We said Bobby Fisher, right? Didn't we say that?
We didn't say that. We were hunting for her. We came up with Mary Jo Buttafuoco. That was as close as we could do, I think.
Right. Okay. So
the other point of correction is when our guest, the great Danny Nick, was talking about the Nick side of the family, that they came from the German part of France.
Right.
He was trying to come up with the name of that, and we couldn't.
Region, yeah.
And then we moved on, and then it kind of popped into my head. But, you know, as typical for New Orleans and the Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge, I was close. I said, All Saints Lorraine. And he goes, yeah, All Saints Lorraine.
Yeah.
And he repeats it about four or five more times.
Yeah, it's wrong.
It's in fact All Saints Lorraine. Doesn't have an N or a T, but you know, just so that is in fact the Germanic region of France, All Saints Lorraine.
All right.
So
good for
that. I stand corrected.
Good for that.
And Manny, it's a big moment here. We've been leading up to this for some time.
Yeah, I've been waiting.
I have the presentation of the Bosco.
Bosco! Thank you, my friend.
Oh, man. You don't know what I had to go through.
I know. I got my Bosco. Yeah, I grew up with Bosco on the West Coast, even though this is an East Coast thing.
Yeah, we had Bosco down here, but you don't see it anymore.
You don't see it anymore. And I had a bottle that I ran out of about a year or so ago. And he said he was going up to the East Coast, and I said, get me a bottle of Bosco, man. Thank you, man. I know you went through a lot to get to this. I'm going to go home and probably have a Bosco banana split.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's really good.
The Bosco, to me, it's a chocolate syrup. Now, to my recollection, I haven't had Bosco in probably 45 years.
Let's do some shots after the show. We'll do some shots.
Sure, yeah, yeah. It's, it has a little bit of a grittier texture than Hershey's.
About, yeah.
Okay.
Like when you're making chocolate milk with it, it takes like way many more stirs to get it all going. Whereas
dissolved.
Like Hershey's, Hershey's is like two, three, four, five. Yeah,
yeah,
it's just like it's there. But Bosco, you got to really work it.
It's got some heft to it.
Yeah,
stiffness.
Yeah. So yeah, you went. You had to. You couldn't go to. I thought you were supposed to get it in Georgia. What happened there?
Well, because then the guy when I got there, I was like, "You got my Bosco?" And he goes, "Oh, bruh, I took it out of my bag. It's sitting in my studio." So in Gonzales, Louisiana, which is an hour from here. So
right.
You know. You're aggravating the soul out of me about the Bosco. You texted me at 4 a.m. on Sunday morning about the Bosco.
Where's the Bosco?
And so I thought, well, I wanted to go see my friend's studio anyway, and I'll take the drive. And you talked about Jack in the Box being in Gonzales. So I thought, okay, I kill two birds with one stone, or three birds. I'll see the studio. I'll get the Bosco, and I'll get a sourdough hamburger at Jack in the Box.
Is that the first time you've ever been to Jack in the Box?
I think I've been before, but you know, not really intentionally. No,
right.
I'm not there to get the certain thing.
Man,
I got to say, Jack in the Box, it's got a weird vibe to it, man. Like their whole marketing campaign, they have the human body with the Jack in the Box head.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the residence
the for your
or something.
Antenna. You get the thing for your car antenna.
Well, yeah. So then they gave me this little favor here.
That's for Halloween.
Some kind of cross promotional item, maybe. That's I don't know.
Well, they used to have those for your car antenna. Is that for your car antenna?
Yeah, nobody has car antennas anymore. But this is like, it's a small foam, like an inch and a half.
For your pencil or something.
Yeah, I don't know what you do. You put that on your wrist or something. Put it around your cock. Maybe
it could be. Yeah, it looks like this could
cock ring,
be a good little sensitive little thing
something,
for your female partner.
I see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, great. Well, thank you. And did you enjoy the sandwich?
Yeah, it was good. You know, now it comes with cheese and bacon, which I'm not going to have on a hamburger. But the people were very accommodating. They're very friendly there. That's why the lady gave me this little favor, because she was so friendly. And she saw that it was my first time, you know.
Now,
really.
You kept asking me if you wanted to, you could bring me some.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. I mean, you were like, you sure? I said, yeah, positive. Thank you. And you know what? Because I'm a firm believer that you have to eat fast food fast.
Sure. Yeah, I get that.
You can't just order it and drive an hour. Or not even, for me, it's not even like 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you're
going to
get fast food
right away.
That's why it's called fast food,
right.
To me. It's like,
no, it has a short shelf life. I agree.
Yeah, so that's why I declined your offer. But I was thinking, you know, you could have went, you know, because Gonzales is famous for those outlet stores, too. They have a lot about those good outlet stores.
Well, I didn't have any more time to kill. That was as much time as I could spare. Okay. Well, we're going real long here.
All right, let's introduce
our guest.
Yeah. Because he's fucked up. I can tell already, man.
He's been
drinking, man.
He's been doing this for a few days, man.
Yeah.
What are you drinking there, man? What is that?
It's Brutes champagne.
Oh.
Okay.
I think that's the first time
we've had a guest drinking champagne, but I like it.
Oh, great.
Me and Alex Chilton, when we weren't drinking, occasionally we'd be somewhere like, let's get a small, we'd split one of those,
Awesome.
And that we'd have one glass each, and that would be it.
That's amazing.
That's, anyway.
They have champagne here?
You know,
dump?
A little bottle, you know. Yeah,
I asked and they had something, so there you go.
All right, well, there's plenty more, I'm sure. All right.
Okay, so our guest is a terrific guest. I've known of this guy for a long time. He's a terrific musician, producer, writer, film composer. He's been in the singer and guitar player and songwriter with the art rock band A Fragile Tomorrow for about 20 years. They've toured internationally with all kind of bands, the Bangles, Matthew Sweet, Indigo Girls. He's also the co-founding editor of the Savannahian.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
It's a hard word to say. It's a digital news publication in Savannah, Georgia, where I guess he lives now. Mm-hmm. And the reason he's here today, or one of the reasons, he's also the author of the new book about our good buddies, the Continental Drifters, titled White Noise and Lightning, the Continental Drifters Story. And he's also the co-producer of the We Are All Drifters companion tribute CD that the Iguanas actually did one track for. Thank you for asking us to do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, without further ado, the great Mr. Sean Kelly. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Glad what you brings you into town?
Doing book stuff. Just trying to sling some books, get people to buy the thing, and just doing promo.
So you're on a whole big tour, promotional tour.
It's like a big three-day
tour,
yeah.
Gonna pack
all
it
all here in New Orleans?
Yeah. We did a book talk in Memphis yesterday at Rhodes College. We're doing Oxford tomorrow, a radio thing in Oxford, Thacker Mountain Radio, and then I'm going home on Friday. It's my son's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday to your son.
Thanks, yeah.
You keep that mic right on your mouth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Let's see, for the listeners that don't know about the Continental Drifters, give them a little background on who the Drifters were.
Yeah, so the band started in late 91, and it was Carlo Nucio, and he had just, there was you probably know this, the pre-Subdudes, Subdudes was the Continental Drifters.
Right.
And it was, Johnny Ray Allen and Tommy was in that band and stuff. And essentially, Carlo was the drummer, and that band became the Subdudes. And the way Carlo told it was like he left to go to L.A. to do some sessions, and they had a gig, so they did an acoustic thing. And he was like, I came back early, and they were doing something with a tambourine, and I thought it was really cool, and they decided that that's what the band was. So then I was out of Condo Drifters, and they became Subdudes. So he basically asked if he could take the name,
right.
And he was trying to do this thing with Mark Walton from the Dream Syndicate in L.A., and then they started the Continental Drifters. And
so they
Ray
had
Gana Show and
Ray Gana Show and go ahead Peter
Gary
Holes
Eaton.
Apple.
Well,
Gary
it was
Eaton,
yeah. Okay. Ed, Peter came in a little bit later, but
right.
It started at
Raji's.
Raji's,
right?
yeah. And they started a Tuesday night residency there, which they had for about a year and a half or so.
And that was out when Manny was hanging around with Carlo.
Did you see any of those shows at Raji's?
I probably did. I just don't remember. I mean, Raji's, I was in and out of Raji's all the time.
Yeah.
And there was also, who was there? Didn't Carlo play with what's his name? The Rhythm Pigs, or what were their names? I don't know.
Nah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably,
yeah. He played with like a million people.
Yeah, he was playing with everyone. And, I just remember Carlo's famous line is, to me, I always remember this line is like, I'll go in on a 40 with you because I've been lit up all night. That was his line that I always remember, at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Sure, sure.
Well,
just to give a thumbnail sketch, because it sounds like you're starting to tell the book there.
People
need to get the book.
Exactly.
But the Continental Drifters were sort of a roots rock, Americana supergroup that had Vicki Peterson from the Bangles, Susan Cowsill, Peter Holzapfel from the DBs, Carlo Nucio from A Million Bands, Gary Eaton, Danny Magoo originally
in the band.
But ultimately, the band kind of had some different eras.
Yeah.
And but they were at one time like named Best Unsigned Band by Rolling Stone magazine.
That's right.
And toured all around the country and kind of a sprawling familial sort of a Fleetwood Mac kind of operation with all the drama and intrigue that goes along
marriages
with that.
And divorces
and all that
stuff. Yeah.
So you became a fan somewhere along the line, huh? Like early on.
Oh yeah, I was. So I was born in 91. So I kind of missed all of that, but I became a fan when I was probably. I mean, I first heard of the Drifters when I was probably about 7 or 8 years old, and to make a long story short. Like, I was a Hootie and the Blowfish fan in 1994. It was like the first band I ever heard. Everybody had that record. My family got that record.
And you were 3 years old.
And I was 3 years
old. Okay.
And so probably by the time I was... I'm 32.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
All right.
So, and that... But the thing that Hootie gave me really was, like, they were the gateway to basically R.E.M. And R.E.M. became my sort of North Star musically.
Okay.
So,
Top Jimmy. That's the guy.
Top Jimmy.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
On the Rhythm Pigs.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay.
And the connection between Hootie and R.E.M. is Peter Holzapfel, that he's played with both of those bands. So, like, naturally, I just kind of discovered stuff that Peter was doing. And the Drifters just was like a name that I kept seeing. Like there was some concert film that Hootie did where he was wearing a Drifters shirt the whole show, and I just and you could see the band name very clearly on the shirt. So like as a little kid, I sort of kept seeing it, and kept, and then, you know, I'd buy the records, and like Susan Castle's name would be on these records and all this kind of stuff. And I probably, when I was 10 or 11 is when I really got into the band, and I got, I think Vermillion was the one of the first CDs that I actually bought. And I grew up in New York, so like I didn't see any of the shows. I never got to see the band. It was just that record was like in FYE or whatever the big chain was. And I just asked my mom if she could buy it for me, and she got it. And so like from the time I really like got into them, I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And that's kind of how it started. I knew the Drifters before I really understood like DBs or Bangles or Castles or anything. I was a Drifters fan first, okay, for sure.
So yeah, they ended up actually getting signed and making records?
Yeah, they were with Razor and Tie for a few records. I mean, you're like the end of the 90s.
So you're 3 years old and you're buying their records.
3 years old listening to Hootie, but by the when I was buying there, I was probably 10 when I bought that CD. Yeah.
And you grew up in New York, and then where do you?
Let's go back a little bit and talk about you some. So, where are you born? Where'd you grow up? What's your family like? Tell us that.
Yeah, so born in the Hudson Valley area of New York, so like an hour and a half north of the city, Newburgh, Poughkeepsie, that whole area. I'm a triplet. And I have an identical brother, and then my younger brother, that were both in my band with me. We started a band when I was 11 when I started writing songs, and just kind of like playing in our parents' basement, that kind of classic thing. And they bought us like shitty amps and guitars, and that's just what we did for a couple years.
Y'all were a self-contained band. Somebody played drums.
Yeah. I think I played drums for like a song and then realized I fucking sucked at drums. So I was like, I'm going to just play guitar. But yeah, my brother Dom was a drummer. My brother Brendan was a lead guitar player, and we didn't have a bass player.
Okay.
And then, met this guy, Sean Rhodes, who's now like a brother basically. And he joined the band in like 2005. And that was the lineup for the everything else after that. So yeah, we just kind of started a band as kids, and like, you know, was listening to REM and Let's Active and the DBs and the Drifters, and that was kind of like our world a little bit. That's all the stuff that we kind of pulled from musically,
right?
And my parents were not the stuff that my parents were into. Like my dad got me into like XTC and Squeeze and those kind of bands. Uh-huh. That's the stuff that he was into. My mom was into like En Vogue and that kind of stuff, okay, which was not my cup of tea. But yeah, so really like the stuff that I was into musically had nothing to do with like my parents listening to it and stuff. It really was just like independent self-discovery. I was like kind of discovering myself and discovering music, just by like being on a Windows computer and you know, listening to internet radio.
Don't worry about that. My mom listened to salsa. My dad listened to Paul Harvey.
Oh yeah, there you go.
The rest of the story.
Yeah, you know. So I wasn't influenced by any of them.
Right.
You know. So is that the same band, A Fragile Tomorrow, that you still have?
Yeah.
Okay.
same band. The lineup basically didn't change until my brother Dom left, because he started getting into political work, and he was on the Stacey Abrams campaign in Georgia a couple of years ago, and it's just way too busy to be in a band, right, basically.
Right. Well, that's why you can be in your early 30s and having been in this band almost 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, yeah, because we were kids, literally. Right. My dad literally used to, like, when we play in bars, he would take us to the gigs.
So y'all were playing in clubs at what age?
Oh, man, I think our first, like, public gig, I was probably 13.
Okay.
My brother Brendan was, like, 11.
That's when I started playing.
We played, like, The Chance in Poughkeepsie, which is this big kind of mid-sized club, and we play with, like, 8 other bands, and we have to buy tickets and all that kind of shit. And that was what we did for years.
So you had to
pay
to play?
Yeah, it was pay to play. It was an absolute fucking scam, but we loved it because we got to play on a big stage and we thought it was the best thing ever.
Sure.
You meet a lot of chicks at 11 years
old?
No,
God, no. No. I mean, I'm sure I wanted to, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of 11-year-old girls or 12, 13-year-old girls at the club.
No, definitely not. And then we'd play like the...
But there's probably like 18-year-old girls there, right?
Probably, but yeah.
That's a big age differential.
It's a pretty big age gap.
Not to school teachers.
No, I guess you're right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. And we'd play like street fairs and stuff, and that's when like some of the girls from school would come and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was definitely like trying to impress a little bit, but I mean, I was also the kid walking around with REM CDs in 2004, and everybody was like, nobody was listening to that shit.
Yeah,
you know?
That was
like, who are these old people that you're listening to? So nobody was like, I don't think I impressed very many people at that age.
So, but at some point you actually meet some of them, right?
Yeah.
You meet Susan Cowsill, I think.
I met Susan we just figured it out. She kept saying I was 12. I was 13 when I met Susan. And she was playing in Buffalo, New York. She was opening for Hootie, and we decided to take the 6-hour drive and go to this Hootie show. And, I didn't realize that she was opening the show. I think she was like a last minute addition because the direct support dropped off or something.
Uh-huh.
And when I got there, she was line checking like right before her set. And I heard her voice and I was like, is that Susan Cowsill? And I was like losing my mind. I was like, what? You know, she's instantly, you can tell when it's Susan.
She is sublime, isn't she?
Oh my God. And I had never, like, just to see her up on this big stage, this festival stage, like singing was just like transformative, totally. And after her set, my dad spotted her at the merch table selling her merch, and like it was her and Russ and Rob Savoy and Chris Knotts, I think, was the band, and they were just like slinging t-shirts and stuff, and dad goes, you should go over there and say hi. And I was like, no, I can't do it. And he basically pushed me like over there, and I go up to Susan and I'm like, hi, Miss Cowsill, my name's Sean and I'm a Continental Drifters fan, Cowsills, and blah blah blah. And she goes, bullshit. That's literally what she said to me. And she's like, who put you up to this? I was like, I promise you, nobody put me up to this. And and she says that it was like one of those, you know how Susan is, like she kind of has this cosmic thing. She's like, everything is like, you know, a previous life and that sort of thing.
Right.
She says she felt like she knew me already.
Oh,
and nice. I feel like I kind of felt the same way. And
nice.
Basically, I had just started writing songs a couple years earlier, and I just sent her demos and stuff, and we kind of just kept in touch. And then Peter Holsapple, I reached out to on MySpace like the next year, not expecting him to respond at all, because in my mind, he's a celebrity, and like, why would he, you know, get back to me? And it was same thing. I just sent him demos.
He refuses to come on this show, apparently.
You know, I'm going to have to talk to him about that.
You know, we don't want to twist his arm. You know, I understand Peter has his reasons.
Yeah, of course.
I'd like to know his reasons.
All that. You know, I've known Peter longer than any of those people. And,
really?
Yeah, I first met Peter probably in 1984 or something.
Wow.
Maybe Peter's afraid I may tell some stories out of school or something. I would never do that, Peter.
No, he told a lot of stories in the book. So.
We don't need him on this show.
I like Peter.
Yeah. But I met him the next year. Like, I sent him demos, and he apparently, Alex, I've never done any of that stuff.
Okay.
Well, there's still time.
Never?
The first time I ever smoked weed.
Well, the night
was,
is young, my friend.
You don't need to blow your mind like Brian did, but you need to open the door.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The first time I ever smoked weed was with a bunch of Cowsills, actually.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's time for stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, psychedelics is a young person's drug. You don't want to wait too long, because the more life you've lived, the more opportunity for regret and self-recrimination there can
be.
And I think, you know, psychedelics gets in. That's why a lot of people that get older, they stop doing psychedelics. Like, I've lived too much. I got too much history to expose myself to the potential downside.
Right.
Maybe we should take a little break here, Manny.
Okay.
I'm looking at my drink, and I know we barely scratched the surface on this, but we're going to refuel and really dig in on this next segment. So,
Troubled Nation knows what drill, buddy. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
About you on vacation, over winning. that's when I remember. That's when I remember. I remember you. I remember you. Well, I don't think about you when I'm sleeping. It doesn't even cross my dream like mine.
We're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Sean Kelly. Now, Sean, as a listener to the show, you're familiar with our listener support operation that we have going here. And the listeners from last week's show will recall that we had an unusual package delivery last week and opened it up. And it turned out it was a whole bag of loose change.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I love the flair that was involved in that gesture. But I wouldn't suggest that anyone try to replicate Eddie V's his move there, because it was like $12 in postage to deliver probably $25 in change. And we'd prefer that you just put it all into supporting the Troubled Men podcast. So you can put that in cash and send it to, Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge, care of the Troubled Men podcast, Manny and Renee. Or you can use the easier way, that a more modern, cashless, touchless system we have now, the Venmo and the PayPal links that we have in the show notes of every show, and the Facebook page. And, we also have the Patreon, all of our patrons, a handful of patrons that support us week in and week out. You can sign up for that. It doesn't really get you anything except the satisfaction of a good deed. Well done. And I may come over and mow your lawn at some point, but that remains to be seen. Also, we have the Troubled Men podcast T-shirts still available there, and the link there is in the show notes. Don't wait too long for the holiday gift giving season. Also, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars; costs you nothing, helps us a lot. Also, follow us on social media: Instagram, Facebook. And
so why haven't you cashed us coins in, man?
Well, because I realized that we missed an opportunity to get a picture with the coin. So okay. I saved the coins. We have the Bosco and the coins. So I wanted to have all the props for the photo this week.
I think it's okay if people are willing to spend, that much in postage. Because people probably just want to get rid of their change.
Okay, I see your point.
If you've got like 80 cents in pennies, send it to us.
Okay.
I'll just take it, man.
All right, sure. Yeah. We don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, as they say.
Right.
You know what that means? Look a gift horse in the mouth.
Means, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most people don't. Why don't you tell us?
I don't know. Now I'm second guessing.
Okay.
My...
Well, so the way you check a horse is you look at its teeth.
Right. That's right.
So and if the teeth are going bad, the horse is going bad.
Yeah.
As with people.
Right.
Actually, as it turns out, all mammals really. You don't want to scrutinize a gift is mm-hmm. the thing. You don't
yep. want to. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's what that idiot means.
I probably don't have much time left.
Yeah. Neither do I, man. I'm right behind you, man.
My teeth are horrible.
Yeah. My teeth and my lungs are in a race to the bottom.
Yeah. My life has been like a civil war, and both sides are exhausted. That's basically my life.
Pearls of wisdom.
Yeah. I fought against myself, basically.
I hear you.
You know. Anyway, let's get back to our guest.
Yeah, back to our guest.
He's exciting.
Mr. Sean Kelly. Yeah. Now, Sean, so you're a young man, a teenager. You're meeting your idols. Yep. You're corresponding with them.
Yeah.
This must give you great confidence.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the funny thing is how quickly it went from, like, meeting them and being friendly and them being enthusiastic about the music, and then it turned into, like, chosen family. Like, it became, like, a thing where, like, me and my dad went out to Durham and spent a weekend with Peter and his family and went record shopping and stuff. And, you know, I used to come here and go to Susan's house and just spend, like, 3 or 4 weeks here at a time and just crash in their living room and just hang out with them all the time and became really good friends.
How old are you
then? I mean, from the time I was, like, probably 15 or 16.
Okay.
I would start
coming here.
So
you're still not old enough to get into bars and gigs here in New Orleans or in Memphis or wherever you're in.
No, no.
Raleigh or...
Exactly,
you know. So you're just hanging outside the gigs?
Basically, and my band opened for the Drifters in 2009 when they did a Carrollton Station gig and the Threadhead thing around
Jazz
Fest.
That's you and your brother's band.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And we asked...
You're called Hanson, right?
Hanson, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
My name's Taylor Hanson.
Oh, okay. Taylor Hanson, okay.
And we asked if we could drive down from New York and open the show, and so we did.
Dad drove?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, your
actually,
dad's
my parent, my both my parents came, and my grandparents flew out too.
Big booster.
Wow, everybody's involved.
Yes,
yeah.
They were all super psyched about it. It was one of our first gigs out of state. Definitely our first tour, I think, and it was a blast. And from then on, I just would kind of come down here all the time, and that's where actually that was the first time that I met Vicki Peterson, and she took us out with the Bangles a couple years later.
She's lovely, isn't she?
She's amazing. She's the best. And that was that tour. I was 19 or 20, and it was all West Coast stuff, like House of Blues, that kind of stuff, the Fillmore. And we weren't allowed in after our set. We weren't allowed to stay in the venues because we were all still underage.
Right.
So we'd have to go. We'd do our set. We'd have to leave, and then we would always get up and do like the sort of like Egyptian thing at the end of their set. So we were allowed to come back in for that.
Okay.
But that was kind of our life. We would just play our set and have to leave venues all the time because we were too young.
Right.
So how were the responses from the audience for you guys?
I guess people liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always
felt
like...
Did you make any records?
Yeah. Our first record, quote unquote, was we made in 2005 or 6, and it was like... Definitely this guy in New York who was definitely a con artist, and he was like a travel agent who had a recording studio, and and he was trying to get us to wear like white suits, matching white suits on the album cover, and I was like, fuck no. It was one of those things. And our first proper record, I got a MySpace message from Malcolm Byrne, who was somebody that I knew from the records that he made.
Former guest on the show.
He's been on the show.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Malcolm reached out to us, and he was living in Kingston, New York. And I guess his wife heard some of our stuff on like the internet somewhere and was like, hey, you should work with these kids. And so we went and made a record with him. And that was our first, that was my first time in a real studio was at Malcolm's house.
Well, that's got to be a shock to your first time in the studio.
Terrifying.
Being with Malcolm.
Yeah. Terrifying. And he was really great to us and just very
Malcolm
nurturing.
Malcolm has mellowed over the years.
Absolutely mellowed.
You
yes.
got him. Yeah. He was,
yes, for sure. Yeah. This is like 2006 or seven.
Right.
Definitely
right.
mellowed for sure. But it was like the first time that I'd ever had like a producer in a room with me or like
Malcolm is so talented, man. Malcolm,
oh my God.
Just the way that guy just to watch him do a live mix of something, it looks like someone playing an instrument. It's a performance and it has all of the life of a performance.
I learned so much from him on that record, really. It was the first time that I realized I wanted to work in studios. That was like the first time that I was like, oh, I could like I liked playing live, but it wasn't like my comfort zone really.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I was like, wow, I actually really love being in a studio. And Malcolm just made it the most fun like experience. And he taught me about like the whole less is more thing. Like I remember my brother had this drum pattern in a song and it was really busy. And we didn't think anything of it because we were kids. And I remember Malcolm saying, like, hey, what if you just kind of cut that down, like cut it in half, make it a little bit more spacious, and it just totally changed the song, and it was like a light bulb moment. And as like a 14, 15-year-old, it was just like, wow, okay, yeah, this is what this is about.
Man, look, I remember being in sessions with Malcolm, and I was telling somebody this the other day, and where the band's playing, and Malcolm walks in and he like picks one of the drums and he takes it away. He takes it out of the room.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Like, no, I don't want you to play that drum. I'm just going to take it away from you. Not even saying, can you play less?
Not even getting the chance to hit this. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I loved working with Malcolm, and the great thing is we kept working with him. Like he worked with this guy from Canada a bunch of years ago, probably like 10 years ago now, and he was going to get like Tony Levin and all these guys in to do session work. And Malcolm was like, what if you have a band as your band? And he's like, yeah, but I don't really know. And he's like, my favorite band, they're these, we were in our 20s at the time. He's like, my favorite band is called A Fragile Tomorrow, and this is who you want to be your band.
Oh, cool.
So Malcolm hired us for this session. He did a lot of that stuff for us.
Right.
And he used to come see us, like he came see us at like a restaurant gig a couple times in Kingston or something or nearby. And like, he loved my mom and stuff. Like it was just the best. It was a really formative time in my life, like learning from him and getting to make music with him was just like the best. Yeah.
Yeah, man, it's terrific. Well, you know, I actually misspoke earlier. I said that, that I'd known Peter Holzapfel the longest since 84. Mm-hmm. I actually have known, Carlo Nucio the longest because I've known him since I'm 14 years old and he was 16.
Wow. Oh my God.
And actually, Carlo and I were kind of like in the New Orleans version of Malcolm's go-to band, you know, like that's how we wound up being in that Switzerland, Stefan Eicher record.
The story that's in the book. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Cause he brought us all over there and said, well, you know, yeah, there is, cause this guy, Stefan Eicher, is like, yeah, we could get Pino Palladino and, Manu Cachet.
Yeah, exactly.
And Malcolm's like, maybe we don't get any rock stars. Why don't I bring like a band from New Orleans.
Brilliant. Totally the right move for sure. Yeah.
Did Carlo ever borrow any money from you?
No, I didn't know him that well. I think if I had, he might have.
Yeah.
Well, this was, and I mean, you know,
dodged
more recently.
Yeah, dodged a bullet already.
I heard some stories.
Yeah.
To get back to the book, so you're developing professionally, you have this ongoing relationship with these guys.
Yeah.
You know, making records, your band's put out like 7 records or so up till now.
Yep.
So you have now the writing, that's something I wanted to get to. When does that come into play all along the way?
I mean, I started writing for money when I was like 16. I was writing music reviews for, I don't even remember what the site was called.
I don't want to tell you what I was doing for money, but go ahead.
I was
giving hand jobs under the Crescent City.
Well,
bridge.
You know what?
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
$15
making more
a
money
hand
than
job.
I was.
Well, which is an odd price to ask for. You think it's 10 or 20.
Yeah, but it adds up.
Because at 15, you got to make change.
2 for $25.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's a good deal.
Yeah.
That's
still got to make change.
Brilliant, man.
Yeah.
I should have thought of that.
Yeah, you usually get a tip when you have an odd. Moving on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah, totally. No, I was like 16 when I started writing, and it's just kind of what I was doing. I mean, I remember writing when I was like in kindergarten. I wrote a book about the Kelly family, and my mom literally was like, "You're gonna write a book one day."
Nice.
And it was just a thing. I just started writing and
who's the Kelly?
My family.
Oh, your family.
I just wrote a book about my family, like in kindergarten.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I guess it was interesting enough.
It was a horror story?
Yeah, definitely. Real scary.
Yeah. Triplets has got to be tough for a family.
I mean, Jesus. Triplets, and we're all disabled. We had nurses around the house all the time, and it was a rough go.
Any other siblings? Just the three of you.
And then I have a younger brother who's a couple years younger. He's in the band.
Okay. Yeah. He's in the band too.
Yeah. So and
nobody escapes.
No, nobody escapes. Yeah, we're on hiatus now, but we can't really break up because we're brothers.
Sure.
It's just kind of how it goes. But yeah, and then, so writing was like sort of just a thing that I did because I needed to make money while I was touring, basically. And it was like, you know, you could do that on the internet in 2007 or 8 or whatever.
Not an easy way to make money, though.
No, not at all. I hardly made anything.
Okay.
But it just kind of led to other things. And then, like, eventually I was an arts editor at a newspaper in Savannah shortly after I moved to Savannah. And that just it was just kind of what I did.
Yeah, why'd you move to Savannah? A woman?
I met my wife in Savannah, but it's not because of, so I it's actually kind of Drifters related a little bit. So we made a record with Mitch Easter at his studio in North Carolina, and the engineer on that session was a local guy that that was a friend of Mitch's, and he became friends with us and like played some gigs with us. And he called me one day. He's like, I'm moving to Savannah because my wife got a job at SCAD, and I need to have, I have all this shit for my other studios. And so
South Carolina,
SCAD is.
SCAD is Savannah College of Art and Design.
There you go.
Yeah.
Gogo Borjading went there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Former guest of ours.
Oh, cool. So he calls me and he's like, I got to open a space because I have all this shit. And he's like, if you ever wanted to open a recording studio? And I was like, yes, literally since the time I was, you know, I don't know, since I was 14 or something, I got Pro Tools. And I was like, yeah, I'm in. And just that, so I was kind of, I was in Charleston, South Carolina at the time, actually. We'd moved to Charleston because we'd gotten to know the Hootie and the Blowfish guys and stuff and some people that like in the Charleston music scene. And I was kind of going back and forth and we were kind of putting the studio together, and then eventually I just realized like maybe I should just give it a shot, and move down and was kind of doing that. This is kind of what I did, like not as a day job because we didn't really make money doing it, but it was kind of my thing. You know, we kind of really weren't touring very much anymore, not as much anyway, and so I was doing a lot of studio work, and then I met my wife. So I was almost going to move back to Charleston. Then I was like, something's keeping me here. I don't know what it is. And then we met, and now we have two kids. So
nice.
Yeah.
So one of those writing stuff. Reviews, what, album reviews or concert reviews?
Album reviews. And I think I remember writing a review for like Neil Young's newest record at the time. And this must have been like 2006 or 7. So I don't remember what record that was.
Are you a Neil fan? I hope so.
Oh, yeah. Not like... really like encyclopedic, but yeah, for sure. I mean, like
I saw him at Jazz Fest with Crazy Horse.
Oh, really?
What a fucking revelation, man.
Was that last year?
This year. This past year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking the band plays so simply, man.
And
Ralph
he's banging Daryl Hannah, which is not bad either.
that's right. Yeah. That's been going on.
She's lucky to have him.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
She's like an Amazon woman, man. I've met her. She's really tall, man. I love tall women.
Neil's a tall drink of water.
Yeah.
So.
He is. Yeah.
So did you ever write any like scathing bad reviews on certain artists?
I don't think I was very good. I felt so weird about doing that stuff. I remember writing a review of a Prince record when it came out, and I mostly loved it, but didn't like a couple of songs. But I was really, I didn't know how to write poorly about something. I just felt weird about it. Maybe I'd be better at it now. I don't know.
So you were thumbs up all the time.
I think so. I was one of those like, I don't want to get too negative with stuff. When I started doing, like, we do some music reviews at the newspaper that I wrote for. And they weren't always like local reviews. The local reviews, I would never write anything negative about a local band in the paper because it would never go well. Yeah, they knew who I was, and it would not be good.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, there was a certain style of writing that became, I don't know, maybe back in the 80s, late 80s and 90s and stuff, where you would see a writer and someone had to explain this to me, Glenn Styler explained. He goes, well, you know, these people write all the time, so they can't write all good reviews, so at some point something's going to come out. It's like, I got to write a bad one. Sorry, man.
Right,
just to balance it out.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
oh,
but yeah, that's
like restaurants, movies, books. You've got to say, eh.
Yeah.
That's so great.
Well, you have to be able to, yeah. I never really got comfortable with that.
But you don't need to do it for your own portfolio is my point.
Oh,
you
know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which in those days it seemed like sometimes people would do that. It's like it's just luck of the draw. It's turned out bad for you. I got to write a bad review on this.
There's
record.
A story about
But there is no bad press, right?
Oh, no, totally.
Yeah.
Well, there's a story about a guy that when the first Hootie record came out, who wrote a really bad review of the Cracked Review in Rolling Stone, and he got, and I think Jan Wenner fired him when they blew up, because he was like, "You're making us look bad." Yeah. And that was a kind of, I guess that was a thing back in the day.
Well, Rolling Stone does not have the greatest track record.
No.
Going back revisionist history, you know, go back and go, wow, you guys got a lot of shit wrong.
But they did name the Continental Drifters one of the best unsigned bands in the country, so they got something right, I guess.
At some point,
they've gotten a few things right.
But. Yeah, no. So at some point, you decide that the Continental Drifters, even though this is something no one your age remembers,
not at all,
you're going to write a book about it.
Yeah.
What possessed you? How do you wind up conning Tim Lee here into underwriting all this?
it's been a long con.
Those are the best ones.
Yeah, totally. So I had the idea when the band did these reunion shows in 2015 with all 10 people who had ever been in the band. They did like a compilation on Omnivore Recordings, and they did these shows, and they did one at Tips.
What a great label, by the way. Omnivore
is amazing. Yeah, amazing.
Cheryl Pawelski.
Oh, Cheryl is the best. Yeah, yes. Love Cheryl. So they did a show at Tips, and they did two shows in Santa Monica at the Morgan Wixon Theater. And I was trying to go to the Tips show, and I couldn't make it out, so I begged my parents to split the airfare to go to LA, and I just wanted to see everybody. So I flew out to those shows, and I stayed with Vicky. And that's for the first time I smoked weed, and it was great. And I was sitting, they had like these tables set up behind the stage, and I was just, I had a lot of Guinness, and I was just sitting there just like watching these people, and I was just like, why has nobody written a book about this band? I'm just thinking about the story and the connections and the family shit and all that stuff. And I kind of thought like, somebody will do it at some point. And I don't know why, but it popped into my head again like a few years later. And I happened to be, Susan and Russ asked me to sub on bass for some Cowsill shows. And so I went out and did that. And the idea kind of had come back into my head. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And I was like, I guess I'll just ask Susan and Russ. Because if Susan and Russ say yes, then maybe there's a shot at everybody else saying yes. And so I think they're pretty used to I've had ideas before, and they're very polite about things. And I asked them, I was like, what would you think about me writing a book about the Drifters? And there was like zero hesitation. They just were like, yeah, that sounds great. So I think I called Peter next, and he was like, yeah, sounds great. And everybody was just really game for it. And that's when the idea happened, and, you know, started it like probably 6 or 8 months later, and then put it down when my daughter was born. And it was just like sitting there, about a chapter's worth was just sitting there for like a year and a half or 2 years or something. And then picked it back up again. And it was for about 3 years was just kind of like basically my part-time job. It's just like writing this book, you know, interviewing everybody I could and all that stuff. But the idea is almost 10 years old, really.
Well, I know you. It's an exhaustively researched book because you actually interviewed me.
Yes, exactly.
Which I was like, sure, I'll talk to you, man. You know, I like to talk.
It was great. The thing with so I had spoken to Carlo a few times, and then he got sick, and when he passed, I was trying to figure out, because we hadn't finished his arc in the story yet. And I was like, how am I going to do this? I really wanted to make sure I did it like really respectfully. And so the idea just kind of popped in my head. I was like, I guess if anybody's going to have a chapter devoted to them, it would be Carlo. And it made sense that he'd have his own chapter, because, you know, everybody's got a Carlo story.
Because I'm Carlo.
Yeah, exactly. That's literally, I mean, yeah. Exactly.
Fuck you, I'm Carlo.
Yeah, exactly. So that's when I decided, like, I'm just going to try to talk to anybody who has a Carlo story, basically, and knew him well. Because I didn't know him that well. I met him at those LA shows, and then we just, you know, would correspond on Facebook, basically. And then when we talked for the book, that was kind of the extent that I knew him. So that was really where, like, I just was really trying to talk to as many people as I could. And I really wanted to talk to Keith Morris, because Keith Morris, like Black Flag and Circle Jerks, like as a teenager getting into hardcore punk, like Keith was kind of my hero. So when Carlo kind of told me that he was in a band with Keith and stuff, I was like, at some point I realized like he's probably got some Carlo stories, and sure enough he did. So I was like really trying to talk to Keith and stuff. And it was really just about like honoring his story and his arc as much as I could, you know. And
now,
so,
speaking of Carlo stories,
yeah.
You know, when Carlo passed away, we had this great gig at Tipitina's, all these people. I guess you were there? I actually was supposed
to be there, and just I ended up not being able to make it. I did rent a car to go to that, but didn't end up being able to make it, yeah.
It's rental cars, yeah, that's iffy. but at that thing, people were getting up and telling stories about Carlo, and,
yeah.
You know, it was a beautiful night, and all these people played, you know, Vicky was there, everybody was there, and Pat McLaughlin and all. Mm-hmm. As I'm loading out my equipment, this guy who had been the roadie with John Mooney when Carlo was on the band, Patrick knows him very well, and he sidles up to me as I'm loading shit in my car. He goes, "Hey, man, who the fuck were they talking about in there?" I said, "Well, you know, it's everybody's trying to keep it on the up and up here. You know, his family's here." He goes, "Well, when are we going to tell the real stories, man?" I said, "Well, you know, in Judaism, we have a thing where, you know, like a year after someone passes away, they have a dedication of the headstone where they even put that." I said, "Maybe a year from now, we'll have, like, speaking of Paul Harvey, like the rest of the story."
That's right.
Well, yeah, we talked about that on one of our shows because I missed that whole thing and you brought it up to me.
Right. And actually, I ran into that guy and he said, "Why don't we do it as a podcast?"
I thought, guy?
Well, Patrick. The guy I'm talking about who was saying, "Who are they talking about?" He's like, "You should do that as a podcast, like get all these people to tell
the real Carlo stories?
The Carlo stories where Carlo has me and Manny Chevrolet on the corner of Esplanade and Rampart.
Looking for balloons that he said he threw out.
Dope and he said he put into a garbage can.
Because the cops were looking for
and where we've emptied out a garbage can on the corner and we're searching through it like a couple of... dope fiends who will believe anything. That's a thing, you know. That's a, you know.
Wow.
You know. So anyway, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, yeah. Because
you should write that book, Renee.
Because I missed that thing also because I was detained at the mall, and I totally forgot about it. But we were going to have. You had said we were going to have like the airing of the grievances about Carlo.
Well, not so much grievances, just you know, the telling of the other side of the story, as I say.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I tell these stories with love now. You know, because.
Yeah.
Because again, it's the you know the glow of
you but yeah know, you know we can talk shit about him because he's dead.
Yeah, well, exactly.
You know? If he were alive today, you know, he'd be walking around in the wheelchair going walk on like Jerry's kids, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, you know? Well, Carlo would be the first to sign off on this, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, so on with your story. Yeah, so you're writing the book. It takes you 10 years you're working on this.
But when I actually started it, it was like 5 years.
10 years on the Carlo chapter? That
yes.
Seems like
just
a long
the, yeah,
time.
Yeah.
It's a good chapter.
Could have gone longer, actually. No, it was by the time I started writing it, it was about 5 years, all told, from the time I started writing it to now. But yeah, the idea was first planted in my head 10 years ago.
But then it all came together. So the book gets completed. You the Drifters have like a best of the record release that goes along with this.
Yeah.
And then you organize this tribute record that is chocked full of hits, man, or chocked full of artists. It has like the Iguanas. You got who else? Marshall Crenshaw, Rosie Flores.
Yeah.
Annette Zelenskis, woman we tried to have on the podcast. I got very close, and then somehow I don't know.
I could help you. I could probably help you with that.
I think that ship might have sailed. Steve Wynn, George Porter's and the running partners.
Yeah,
all kind of people. Alex McMurray, Glenn Hartman.
Yeah,
Danny Magoo, on and on. So, man, what a huge release that this is. It's all coming up. You know, the wheel turns, the wheel of fortune turns, and it's coming back up for the Continental Drifters.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It part of the idea was sort of like, you know, I felt like some of the bands that some of the Drifters had been in previously were kind of not. Like they were all getting their due a little bit. Like the Cowsills are kind of having a renaissance right now. The DBs are, people are kind of discovering that stuff and what then their influence. And to me, like the I always felt that the Drifters kind of deserved that same thing, at least like their own version of it. And it just never really happened, and they kind of remained sort of under the radar. So I sort of like felt like, well, if I can help that a little bit, that would be really, really cool. And that's kind of like, that's really where the tribute sort of came in, because one, well, it helps to sell the book a little bit too, to be honest. It's like, sure, get all these people on there, people, and you know, it benefits like the Wild Honey Foundation, which is an autism research org out in LA. And
right.
So like, you know, there's a lot of reasons to get it. But it just felt like a really good opportunity to sort of like spread the word about this music and this band that like I really loved, and a lot of people who love them really love them. So it's been amazing to see like the excitement around it, and like people being really interested in this thing. And I'm super happy with it. The tribute is just like, I actually can't believe that we got that many people to be part of it. It's just kind of like amazing. I'm really, really proud of the work. It took a long ass time to do.
But I'll bet it took a lot of phone calls, a lot of texts.
Oh, man.
I know, just between you and me, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah.
I was just doing one side of it.
Yeah. Well, because people, I mean, everybody who was involved in it donated their time. That's the big thing that like I keep trying to stress, is like, nobody asked for money. And yes, it's a charity thing, so there's that component. But I really believe that it's because like, either the Drifters as a whole or people in the Drifters mean a lot to most of the people that are involved in this thing, and people just want to do something cool for their friends, basically. And I think that really is what it comes down to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm friends with all those people. I've had almost everybody in the band on the podcast over the years, you know, sometimes two and three times.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the Carlos episode with the RV story, when I was kind of working that bit of the book out, I texted him and I was like, when can you talk about this RV story? He's like, man, just go listen to this podcast I did. It's all there. He's like, I don't want to retell it. Just listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. Truly there would have been no reason to have him sit there and tell me about it again, because it's just like the best telling of that story that I could have asked for.
And you know, Sean, that's what keeps me doing this podcast, is stuff like that. You know, it's like, in many cases, the podcast version of whatever someone's story is, or sometimes that person, if you look them up on the internet, the greatest repository of information on their life is a Trouble Men podcast episode they did.
Yeah. That was the center to telling the whole story. I always came back to that episode. Like, I think I had at least 5 pages of notes just listening to that episode. I must have listened to it about 5 times to make sure I had everything. Because Carlo is very, the thing about Carlo is he ended up being very accurate in all of his stories.
Yeah.
And I think he really had the best memory about a lot of stuff. Then,
which is amazing.
Really kind of wild to say that, but like, it is actually true. He really was very accurate with stuff, which is, yeah, awesome. And there was some stuff where people were like, I don't know if that's how that went down. But then when you kind of like, when you put it up to Carlos telling of it, it's like, no, yeah, that actually makes sense.
Yeah, it sounds, I think he was more reasonable, right? Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, wow, this is what a terrific thing you've done now. So you're out on the promotional tour now. I saw that you did a podcast recently, the Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme podcast.
Oh, yeah.
With a guy I love, Ronnie Barnett.
Oh, Ronnie is so awesome.
Bass player from the Muffs.
Yeah.
And he was a sometimes co-host on that podcast. And
yeah.
He was a co-host on the episode that you did.
Yeah.
And he appeared on this podcast.
Oh, cool.
Years ago, a couple of years, it was during pandemic, is when we were doing it remotely. And we had some technical issues, unfortunately. It's, see, that's why I like to do it. Like here, where
we're
looking at each other in the face, it's way more fun, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. But Ronnie, like I'd never met him. I'm a big Muffs fan, like that.
Me
especially
too.
What a
fucking band! Did you
so
ever
good.
See that band?
No.
I saw them play like maybe 3 or 4 times.
Wow.
So rocking, man.
Oh, man.
So rocking.
He was so good, and he ended up. He actually reached out to me on Instagram and was like, wow, you're doing a Drifters book.
He's such a music fan, man.
Yeah, and he saw them at Raji's years ago.
He saw me play with Chilton in Houston.
Really?
Like, yeah, before he ever went to L.A.
Whoa. Yeah, he's like I was like shocked. I didn't realize that there was a connection, but I guess him and Kim used to go to to see the Drifters at Ed Raji's. I literally had no idea, and then it turns out he actually ended up on the tribute as well, with Steve Wynn.
Oh, cool.
On a song called Green. But yeah, he's just like, it was so cool just getting to have him ask me questions about it. It was just like, I was like, this Ronnie Barnett's fucking awesome. So, and he did call me out, and lovingly called me out, because I call Raji's a dive bar. And he was like, I take issue with that. I think it's, let's call it a club. And I was like, that's fair enough. But
a dive
multiple
club.
People, but sure. Do you think it was would you call it a club or would you call it a dive?
It was a club. It was a club. It was divey,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very divey. It was right on Hollywood.
Yeah.
And
but it was definitely a club. It was kind of like Jimmy's here, you know. It's kind of similar to how that used to be.
You know, it stunk.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah.
The bar was very large, if I remember correctly. But it was right off Hollywood near Gower, which at that time wasn't the best of areas.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan told me she was scared of Raji's. That's what she said.
Well,
I was never scared of Raji's. They had, the good thing about Raji's was on the other side, there was lots of parking. So it was parking. You could go there. Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a lot of other clubs, like on the Strip and stuff. You know, you'd get your car towed if you were at the Roxy or the Whiskey and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, Raji's will always be Raji's, you know.
Yeah.
It is what it is, you know, it is what it was. But good times there, you know.
Oh, I bet.
Well, man, Sean, we're kind of winding up the podcast here.
Yeah.
And wish you all the best with this book. And this
Thank you.
You're doing God's work here, as are we.
If you believe in God, yeah.
I know, but it's. I mean, the sentiment is
this
there.
This is Erev Rosh Hashanah tonight. So,
yeah. Well, I'm also Jewish. Happy New Year to you.
Oh, Happy New Year. Oh,
yeah.
Okay, I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew I liked
Stein,
you.
I'm a Stein on my mom's side.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice.
Italian, Jewish, Irish. That's
it. It is a matrilineal line.
Yeah. 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 Totally.
Lashana Tova.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, man,
right.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. I saved the best for last.
Oh, nice, nice. Well, Sean, as always in the Trouble Men podcast, we like to say trouble never ends.
But Sean, the struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.
Well, the Tucson trip cost a band of bundle dubs to get me out of jail. The gig only paid about half as much as the bail. I'm down to my last clean shirt and I'm trying hard now not to perspire. But it gets awful tough when you're outside stepping the fire. And my old girl, she likes to talk just a little, old man. She can make me uptight. I heard from her cousin that she might be showing tonight. She can dish more pros than cons. I just don't have the strength to try. And it gets kind of hard when you're outside stepping the fire. Well, I made me a list of the things I'm gonna do, how I plan to turn it around to benefit this guy I knew. When I was much younger, someone wiser than today, pissed it all away. Church and cut my old friend Jesus a deal, where I confess that the scripture don't mean nor as much as the meal.
I picked up a couple of box pushing vocal arrangements to an all-boy choir. Then I explained how it's hard when you're outside stepping the fire. Well, I made me a list of the things I'm gonna do, how I plan to turn it around to benefit this guy I knew. When I was much younger, somewhat wiser than today, before I pissed it off.